As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hi there, hello, welcome to the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. I'm Ali Maxwell. With me as ever, Tom Warville and Michael Cox. We have for you today what I consider to be a nice mixed grill of a podcast. We'll start with a quick chat about the big game of the weekend in the Premier League, spin off into a wider discussion about a growing tactical trend at the top of the Premier League, and then we'll make use of Tom Warville's long lens with some young players to watch from across Europe. How are you, Tom? How is that lens?
Good, thanks, Ali. Yep. I'm not going to mention the lens. Yeah, really good. Enjoyed a good weekend of football, especially the second half of the Liverpool Man City game. And yeah, all in all, good. And it just seems a shame again that we've got another international break upon us just as the domestic season was getting up and running. But that's what happens.
Plenty of good stuff in Leagues 1 and 2 this weekend. This is not a, it's not the end of club football for the next 2 weeks. And I don't want anyone to make that point. Michael, you had a busy weekend. All eyes on Anfield on Sunday, but in the flesh at two separate games on Saturday. Your big plan came to fruition at King's Meadow and then at Stamford Bridge. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I did the Chelsea women and Chelsea men double. Both sides won 3-1. Kind of similar games, actually, in that respect. Both teams playing a similar system now, actually, this season, 3-4-3. So, yeah, it was quite fun. There was a few people doing the same. I noticed as soon as Bethany England scored Chelsea women's third with about 10 minutes to go, I went for the early train from Norbiton to make sure we were there in time for kickoff.
I like the idea of you walking at the front of the pack with your arm up, just everyone following Michael to the bridge.
Yeah, I actually, en route, changed my plan and got the bus to another station and then got a slightly quicker train. But
as if you're being tailed.
Yeah, well, that's just local knowledge for you, you know. Gone to King's Meadow many times before. So, yeah, it was a fun day. It worked out quite nicely. And it was torrential rain on Saturday. And I think maybe there was some people who might have fancied doing the same, but were kind of put off by that weather because I did get absolutely soaked, to be fair.
Fair weather fans, there's literally a word for that. hey, what are the tactical similarities and I suppose the nuances within those two systems, Tuchel's Chelsea and Hayes's Chelsea?
Yeah, it's quite interesting to observe. I mean, I don't think there's any evidence that Hayes has directly been inspired by Tuchel, but at the same time, when you look at the job he's done since he took over, surely every coach in England will have been sitting up and taking notice and having a look at what he's done. So, I mean, it's a bit of a surprise considering Chelsea won the league last year. They got to the Champions League final. It's quite a dramatic switch. I think the most interesting thing about this, and maybe I can make an appeal to our podcast listeners for any similar examples, is Chelsea playing a back three. Last year, their two centre-backs were Magdalena Eriksson to the left and Millie Bright to the right. But one of the full-backs from last year, well, she often played full-back. She's definitely not a centre-back. She's more of a midfielder. Jess Carter is now playing between the other centre-backs, which I think seems very rare. I mean, it's the equivalent of them putting, you know, Azpilicueta between, say, Rudiger and Thiago Silva. It just feels really
weird.
And
does she sweep up behind the back line or does she step into midfield in possession?
A little bit, but without possession, she's sweeping up and she's quite good at distributing the ball forward. I'd say probably not as good as the other two, actually, although they're quite good at playing diagonals, so maybe it makes sense for them to be in the wider positions. Actually, I think in the first game against Arsenal, it was Bright in the centre of the three, and now they've moved her to the right. But yeah, I'm just intrigued by how Carter's gone from being a midfielder to a fullback to the centre of three defenders, between very much two obvious centre-backs. I just haven't seen anything like it before. It feels like maybe kind of a Serie A club in the 1990s might have done something similar when they were like specialist sweepers who would maybe be a bit more technical. But if anyone has any examples, I'd be very interested to know.
One of the notable things about Tuchel's Chelsea on Saturday was the presence of quite a few players that I would consider to be fringe players. Chelsea under Tuchel have mostly been fortunate with injuries, and certainly in the second half of last season, there was a pretty core squad of, 14, 15 players. But on Saturday, we saw Trevor Chalobah score his second Premier League goal of the season. Ruben Loftus-Cheek flicked it on for him to score from that set piece and played in midfield. Hudson-Odoi played on the left of the front three. And Ross Barkley came on and played a lovely little raked ball over to Azpilicueta in the build-up to the third goal. Which of those fringe players stood out to you, which might have impressed Tuchel? None of these guys felt hugely likely to be starting a lot of games, I would suggest, for this Chelsea side at the start of the season. But who knows now? Players can play themselves into contention.
Yeah, you're right. I think Hudson-Odoi is probably the most threatening. I thought he was maybe Chelsea's best player in the first half, playing wide on the left. There's just so much competition for places in the front three for Chelsea. But it was clear that for this game, Tuchel wanted someone playing very much out wide rather than drifting inside. And he played as a very wide winger. Chalobah has barely put a foot wrong, when he's received opportunities this year. So certainly, I think, positive for him. Loftus-Cheek, I've never particularly got Loftus-Cheek, I must say. I think if you're going to give him an opportunity, it did make sense for this game, because we know that Southampton pressed very high, pressed very effectively at times. And he's very good at turning away from pressure and kind of drifting into attack. But I often think his final ball is a little bit lacking. I was quite surprised. I watched the game and then I watched Match of the Day in the evening, and Ian Wright really highlighted Loftus-Cheek as someone who he thought was outstanding on the day. But I must confess, I didn't really see that. And they've got lots of other options in that position, including Barkley, who like you say, I didn't see this game, but I gather was decent against Juventus when he got a chance. And the pass for Azpilicueta was fantastic. But I also thought the ball across from Azpilicueta, I think it's quite hard to catch that on the half volley and balloon it up, but it was just solidly along the floor. Both two good games. It was a good Saturday.
Next, we'll turn our attention to Sunday's big game in the Premier League, Liverpool 2, Manchester City 2. Michael, you did the Lord's work with a sort of reverse jinx at halftime in this game, because you tweeted that overall, if anything, you weren't very impressed with the overall quality of the game.
I thought the first half was dreadful. I mean, not necessarily just an entertainment value, but the technical quality. I thought that both teams were all over the place. De Bruyne was just doing some actually ridiculous things, just poor touches, bad passes. I thought the level of first touch from both sides was really poor. And it was quite funny at the end to, after the game, to hear so many people saying, oh, it was a brilliant game, one of the best I've seen for ages. And it kind of was, but only really the second half. I mean, it goes to show that when they changed from 2 points to a win to 3 points to a win, Jimmy Hill's argument was that fans went home remembering the last 20, 30 minutes more than the rest of the game. And therefore, he didn't want teams to be settling for a point. He wanted teams to be going for it.
Right.
And I think this is a kind of situation that maybe shows that he's right, because games very rarely have complete intensity over 90 minutes. And if you're going to have a half of great intensity, you kind of better, builds up to a really good second half, then you have a first half and it tails off. It was a great game, but I can't imagine many people would be watching the first half again.
Well, Klopp might watch it back a few times, Tom, to work out what was going on with his team. He was not happy with his side's first half performance at all.
No, not at all. And it's something that if you look at the kind of XG race chart for the game, the first half, Liverpool are practically flat. I think they had one shot in the first half in total, and I think they're averaging 14 a game of the season, so there's a lot of kind of work to do in the second half, and City were around 0.8 XG in the first half, which wasn't amazing by their standards, but it was still pretty good given it was Liverpool. But I found kind of Klopp's quote at full time really interesting. It feels like it might be one of those that we come back to at certain points in the future. I mean, he said that, thank God a football game has two halves. We are really happy about the second half and not so happy about the first half for obvious reasons. We did a lot of things wrong in the first half and City did a lot of things right. I was most happy in my career about the halftime whistle because it's tricky to get into contact with the players to change things. It was obviously never planned that we play like this. We needed half time and we used half time and we played a really good second half. So maybe Klopp actually would be a proponent of Julian Nagelsmann's earpiece idea, and it would have saved him sprinting down the tunnel at half time. But certainly a game, forgive the cliche, but very much a game of two halves, this one.
Michael, we don't want them to get in touch with their players during the game. That's the whole point.
Yeah, completely links back to what we talked about last week, doesn't it? And was similar to Liverpool 3, Brentford 3, in a way, you know, the game was out of control. You know, the managers were not exerting that much influence over the proceedings on the pitch, obviously indirectly. But yeah, the game kind of got carried away with itself, and that's why it was so good. If the managers had had a timeout midway through that second half, I think they would have tried to say, right, calm down a bit. Let's have 5-10 minutes in a solid structure. But we didn't have that. We had the game just increasing in momentum and it was fantastic. So, yeah, comes back to what I said last week. I don't want the managers to constantly be interfering with things.
It's funny. I remember one part of the game specifically where it cut to Phil Foden, I think, after a chance or after he'd had possession in Liverpool's final third, and he was kind of, you know, gesturing to his team to calm down. But Alisson restarted the goal kick really quickly, and it just doesn't, you know, even situations like that, it doesn't give him enough time for that message to really obviously get across. And I don't know how much Phil Foden's voice has weight in those situations, you know, in the heat of battle, as it were. But yeah, I just thought even the restarts where you can try and catch your breath and slow things down were seemingly quite manic as well.
Michael, was there any noticeable tactical changes between the first half and the second half, or was the difference in watchability in goals, entertainment, just down to execution?
Yeah, I mean, Klopp explained in great detail some. I think, Tom, did you feature that in the article that you wrote?
Yeah, there's a bit. I don't think I included it in the end, but mainly around kind of them being too passive in the first half and needing to be a bit more active, especially Henderson and Jones, to kind of clog the midfield in the second.
But yeah, I mean, I thought really there was... It was strange because, like I said, I don't think the technical quality was very good in the first half and there's so many poor touches. And usually you associate that pressing. Teams have been pressing much. But I didn't think the first half there was that much pressing in the context of games between these two. When the intensity got higher in the second half, everyone's first touch and their technical ability actually seemed to improve. Yeah. It was almost like they were just jarred into life by the increased... I found it a very strange game. But yeah, definitely a game of two halves.
Tom, you wrote a piece about this game, particularly those pesky half spaces and how they were key to the game and all four goals as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it was just a recurring theme of all of them that they were either scored from or made in those space in the channels between the 6-yard and the 18-yard box. And I think for City, you can look at James Milner a lot and his kind of positioning and lack of pace on the turn and allowing Phil Foden to get behind him. And then for City, it was more around João Cancelo's one-on-one defending and a bit of Aymeric Laporte's positioning. But yeah, really, it was that kind of the route to goal was very much through those areas, and both teams capitalised on them really nicely.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And Michael, while Tom sort of zooming in on this particular 90 minutes, you took this and made a wider point in your piece on The Athletic this week. All four games, you said, came at Anfield from the wide positions, which now seem the primary battleground in top-level football matches. That seems like an important sentence for a tactics writer to write. Talk me through why and how and for how long wide positions have been the primary battleground in these top-level football matches.
Well, I suppose around 10 years ago, particularly when Guardiola's Barcelona were dominating European football, it felt all about getting control of the centre. I mean, that was Guardiola's main strategy, you know, various tactics, but it was always about getting basically a fourth player in that zone. He started with three central midfielders. He'd either have Messi coming in there from false nine position, or he'd have Iniesta drifting in there when he played from the left. It was all about gaining control there. But I don't know whether his teams are just so compact and so well organised in the centre of the pitch, but it's quite rare that I'm writing about a game now and I think, well, it was the midfield battle that really got the upper hand. I think maybe there's also been a shift in terms of, I think even 10 years ago, I think everyone was trying to dominate possession. I think there was a real emphasis upon that. And I'm not sure that's the case now. I think teams have accepted that sometimes they're going to be a bit more reactive, a bit more counter-attacking. And in terms of actually creating chances, I think it's almost shifted towards the flanks. And maybe the two most interesting sides and overachieving sides in European football in the last, 3 years have probably been Ajax and Atalanta, who've both gone on great Champions League runs. Ajax were very good at overloading the wide flanks by basically the winger on one side crossing to the other side and almost combining with the other winger. And Atalanta, who I think have been quite revolutionary in their use of rotations down the flanks. It's almost not a conventional system. They have centre-back, wing-back, central midfielder and a wide forward who almost can play in, you know, as a move unfolds, they almost can play in any of those positions. And we've seen that from other sides as well. And Bielsa at Leeds focuses a lot on rotations. And yeah, we saw that this weekend. We've seen it a lot from Liverpool, I think, increasingly, usually with Henderson, Alexander-Arnold and Salah, you often end up with Alexander-Arnold or Milner for this weekend in a central position. You often end up with Henderson, who's one of the central midfielders, overlapping into space on the outside. And I think teams find it quite difficult to cope with that for various reasons. So, yeah, I focused on that because I didn't think the game was completely explainable through the tactics because it was just so chaotic in the second half.
And do you think there's an extent to which the fullbacks now are, we've talked about fullbacks so much over the last 18 months on this podcast, but are now at a point where we can consider them in terms of build-up play and in terms of a team's attacking ceiling, fullbacks being almost the key men on that front, and particularly whether they are able to bend to the needs of top-level football and be as good in possession as they need to be now that they are operating in the key battleground of top-level games?
I think you're right. And I think, that was what the article's on, really. The fact that it was so common to see the fullbacks making runs inside rather than outside the winger. I mean, for both Manchester City goals, Kyle Walker was making a run as if he wanted to go into the centre forward position from right back. Liverpool did it a lot with Milner being inside. And we know Alexander-Arnold is a much better option in terms of creating from that zone. And I also linked it back to what happened in the game. I was at Stamford Bridge where Thomas Tuchel was constantly screaming for Chilwell to push inside and become a midfielder. And that kind of dragged Southampton's right winger Theo Walcott inside and allowed Hudson-Odoi a lot more space to receive the ball and get Livramento in one against one situation. So, I mean, even 5-6 years ago, you would have said, well, that's a really unusual thing to see. But it's now really common. It's just almost a standard tactic for a lot of the big sides. So to see the top three, and I would say the three title contenders, all doing variations of that fullback making a narrow run, was very interesting at the weekend.
I mean, for De Bruyne's equalising goal, as he struck the ball, there's Kyle Walker on, I mean, he's to the left of the penalty spot. That's the run that he's made, which is quite the development for Walker, someone whose game has been completely opened up by having Guardiola as his manager, you have to think. And also understandably, a very difficult run for any defence to track. You're not going to likely get Mane tracking him all the way to that position, are you? Which means you have to pass on a man, and at the speed with which they play now, that's got to be very, very tough.
Yeah, and especially the speed that Walker can run at as well. I mean, it was Robertson who ended up following him over and gets a slight touch onto the cutback, which deflects through to De Bruyne. And I was trying to make a case. I wonder if Robertson hadn't needed to intercept that, whether he would have been pushing over onto De Bruyne and shut down the shot. I think probably not, to be honest. I think he probably would have been marking Gabriel Jesus on the far side. But yeah, it like you say, it just must be so difficult to track. And I think also, on a different note, the runs Henderson makes, because when you go from inside to out, I think if you're an opposition central midfielder, there's something within you that doesn't want to be dragged out to the flank. Mm. I think if you're a fullback tracking a run inside, that's the danger zone. You're happy to do that and you can leave the flank unoccupied. But central midfielders or centre-backs aren't meant to get dragged out to the flank. It's just a weird... It's almost like anti-gravity. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, you're just not meant to be going in that direction. So, yeah, those Henderson runs, I think, are really effective. Weren't that effective this weekend. He got caught offside once and I think one of the crosses wasn't very good, but... it has been quite a regular source of creativity for Liverpool over the last 2 years, I suppose.
Yeah, the still of Walker's positioning was what stood out in your piece, and also one of Liverpool's setup in build-up play down the right-hand side, where you had, and we always talk about football terminology, don't we? And how sometimes you know, the game has changed so much that it just doesn't seem fitting. You had the wide forward Salah, the narrowest of the three in shot, then the right back James Milner in between Salah and Henderson, the right-sided central midfield player who, in a lot of build-up attacks for Liverpool, was the widest player, closest to the touchline. It's fascinating to see you break it down like that. And then while the Chilwell analysis was probably the most the simplest, I suppose, I did very much enjoy your sentence. What do you call a wing back who is not on the wing or at the back?
Yeah, it's a fair question. I don't know what you call that position, but it's weird to see Chilwell doing. I mean, the thing is with Chilwell, he's clearly had a difficult few months. I mean, he started in the Champions League final, played pretty well. Mm. I think played a big part in the goal, but didn't get. I don't think he got any minutes with England in the Euros, did he? Certainly didn't start any games. Don't think he came on at all. Hasn't played much at the start of this season. Mm. And you think, well, he's gone into the team and he's not merely being asked to return to his best, but also to play a completely different role. But I guess that is the kind of demand that is expected of players in the modern game, especially from someone like Tuchel, who can't remember what interview it was I was reading, but you know, he says his strategy is to make the training sessions so complex that the matches then feel simple. I don't think Ben Chilwell found his task that simple on Saturday, but I do like the idea.
As an aside, his goal, first and foremost, was incredible technique to volley it. It was quite far off the ground to keep it, you know, I was going to say underneath the bar. It was only just underneath the bar, wasn't it? And into the near post. I mean, watching the highlights back, that was one of the most bizarre goals I've seen, certainly this season. In the flesh, Michael, that must have been insane.
To be honest, I actually couldn't work out what happened. I genuinely wasn't sure at what stage the ball had gone over the line, because I was convinced it was quite a good save. So I was like, maybe the it was Azpilicueta, wasn't it, who
it
had the second
Lukaku
shot.
Azpilicueta, yeah. Chilwell, the least likely, yeah, of the three to go in, and yes, and it didn't look like it had gone in either. It looked like, as you say, an incredible save from McCarthy.
Yeah, and also I think lost in that was that it was actually quite a bad miss from Lukaku. I just don't know how he didn't score it, but yeah, the XG is quite interesting. Tom will be able to say something more about this, but there's different models, but presumably it takes the best chance of the three, does it, Tom? So it would be presumably the Lukaku chance rather than Chilwell's shot from a slightly awkward angle.
It's got to be a bit more complicated than that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So I think the way that Opta does it is it adjusts for the rebound. So you essentially look at what's the probability of not scoring from all those chances in succession. And that goes, that kind of like chunk goes into the XG score. But I think the maximum in the possession is probably the right approach, because in this case, you get rewarded for missing good chances in the XG front, which isn't what you want, really, is it?
Going back to terminology. Someone in the comments of your piece, Michael, Steve K, is also a big fan of semantics in football, but not a big fan of your use, or whoever wrote the headlines, use of the term underlapping when we're talking about these fullbacks dipping inside. Steve wrote, minor thing, but I've always been annoyed by the term underlapping as it's come to be used. In overlapping, the over part refers to going ahead of nominally more advanced teammates, i.e. in the vertical direction. It was traditionally always done on the outside, but I don't think that is fundamental to the meaning of the term. So underlapping would be an attacker or midfielder dropping deep, and the movement described here, and by the term in general, should be inner lapping or something else referring to going inside slash narrow. Any thoughts?
I'm not sure I agree. I'd never considered that. I'm not sure I agree. I think... No, it's a...
Rattled.
He says generally on the outside, but it has to be on the outside, surely. You'd never say overlap if a player made a run inside, if a fullback made a run inside.
But I sort of see his point, which is that, well, if he's right, and I don't know if he is, that the over part of that, again, think of it vertically, not using the width of the pitch, is a defender running past a midfield player. Do you not think there's some merit to that point?
I agree, but it has to be, I mean, it has to be on the outside. Mm. I don't agree with his claw. Read it again. What does it say?
Well, the whole thing.
No, the bit about how usually on the outside or whatever.
In overlapping, the over part refers to going ahead of nominally more advanced teammates, i.e. in the vertical direction. It was traditionally always done on the outside, but I don't think that is fundamental to the meaning of the term.
Well, no, I think it... I disagree with you. I think that is fundamental to the meaning of the term.
Right.
I'm up for hearing other listeners' feedback on that.
Also, not a big car guy, but if you overtake someone in the slow lane and they're in the middle lane, that would be called undertaking. So maybe there is a horizontal aspect to this.
That is a very good point. I'm not going to add anything further.
Just to play devil's advocate, if we go by the Cambridge Dictionary, it has nothing to do with going outside or inside. If a football player overlaps, they pass the ball to another member of their team and then run beyond that player so that they are ready to receive the ball again.
I don't agree. I don't think they have to pass the ball to him, do they?
Rip it all up.
There could be a third player. He could have received the ball from the other flank and you make an overlapping run. You don't have...
To be fair,
The ball's irrelevant in this situation, surely.
We can't bring the Cambridge dictionaries. God, that was close. Tactical understanding of the game into question. It's not their job for me.
I'll write a letter.
Producer Adonis says, what if you overlapped in Spain where they drive on the other side of the road? I think that's a good place to leave it. Steve K, you are nothing but a disruptor, but thank you for your comment. Listener, if you've seen teams doing funky stuff with fullbacks or wingbacks, I think you know who to tweet now. This is something I'm sure we'll talk about more as we dissect big games over the rest of the season. And just lastly on this, Michael, we should say that like so many other modern football tactics trends, this can be traced back to Pep Guardiola, who probably is also the godfather of trying to dominate possession and penetrate through the middle. Funky use, as I keep saying, of fullbacks probably traces back to Pep as well.
Yeah, it probably does, to the Alaba and Lahm experiment at Bayern, which seemed quite unique at the time. We thought, who else is going to have fullbacks as technically gifted as Alaba and Lahm, who I think both had been central midfielders in Bayern's youth system. But it turns out lots of teams do. Another one to give credit to Guardiola for.
TheAthletic.com/tactics will get you a third off an annual subscription to The Athletic. You can be Steve K if you sign up to The Athletic today. And reading Tom and Michael's stuff is just an added bonus or a chore, depending on your outlook.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner StubHub has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Let's ask Tom to do some work here. Tom Warville, you wrote a piece recently about four young talents flourishing early on this season across Europe. You are our Euro data scout for the next 15 minutes or so. A bit of added interest and maybe pressure on you here. Kylian Mbappe spoke to L'Equipe and the quotes surfaced overnight. He says he watches nearly all of Ligue 1. He needs to see his opponents and he knows nearly all the players. I watch also all the big matches abroad. And he was asked which players had caught his eye recently. He said there are quite a few. I'm following Nice closely. And Amin Guiri, he is really not bad. He has imposed himself. You can tell these are translated quotes, can't you? He already did a good season last year, and he is in the process of confirming it. Ryan Cherki is also a wonderful talent. He could develop this season. Rennes also have a lot of promising young talents, wingers who break the lines. Aside from that, there are players who I don't think are wow on TV. And then I come across them on the pitch in real life, and I say to myself, wow. They are pretty good. So Mbappe himself is doing some Ligue 1 scouting, as you are too. Please can we start with Mohamed Ali Cho of Angers. Great name, good backstory, really fun player.
Yeah, he's another one who I'd say is really not bad. I think that's my new my new phrase from this point onwards.
Would you say he broke into the first team in the second half of last season and now is in the process of confirming it?
Yeah, I perhaps would do. Although I'm not sure how, if you can... Can you break into the first team if you play around three games worth of minutes? I guess you can do. But anyway, yeah, he broke into the first team. I think he was 16 years old at the time. And he was a former Everton kind of academy player. And Paddy Boylan's written a really good piece kind of detailing who he is and his background and kind of, you know, I guess the circumstances of which why he left Everton, because he looks like a very bright young talent. But so he plays for Angers, and they've got actually a really interesting kind of group for, I guess it's probably one of their better teams for a while this season, and they've actually invested quite heavily. I mean, they've got a guy on the wing called Jimmy Cabot, who I think was linked to a couple of League One sides kind of pre-Brexit when they could have got a work permit, and he's kind of been playing really, really well for them. Quite a small but dynamic winger, very, very quick. They've got Mohamed Ali Cho up front. They've got Sofiane Boufal, who obviously is formerly of Southampton, and an attacking midfielder called Angelo Fulgini, who I think we written about previously on the site, myself and Mark Carey, linking him to potentially a kind of number 10 role for various Premier League sides. But Cho is 17 years old. He's quite slight, but obviously really well built, loves to try and take players on. And I've always found it interesting, players like this who actually plays as a striker and not as a winger, because you just wouldn't really see that in the Premier League or perhaps even in the Championship. They'd probably more be used out wide, but kind of up front, he's playing pretty well. He's got two goals so far. I think he's got 4.2 XG in total if we look at the numbers on FBref, which shows that he's got into some great positions, not quite found his shooting boots yet, and scored a tap-in at the weekend after I wrote this article. So we got a bit of another player to Ali to get kind of the Athletic football tactics boost.
Love it.
I'm just intrigued by the fact that he moved from France to England when he was a week old.
Oh, we've all done it.
I've never heard of such an early... I haven't been in this situation, but I imagine if you've just given birth, the last thing you want to do is emigrate to another country. But I'm very intrigued by that.
Elite Premier League academies just go younger and younger with their recruitment. Well, interestingly, when the international break finishes, Friday the 15th of October, PSG against Angers. So maybe, having not been mentioned by Mbappe in L'Equipe, he's one of those players that Mbappe doesn't think is wow on TV. And maybe when he comes up against him on the pitch in real life, he might say to himself, wow, he is pretty good. What about Mohamed Bayo, who plays for Clermont, born and bred, in fact, in Clermont, and wears the number 9? There's always something quite special about that, I think. Not only that, he fired them to promotion last season, Tom. Who is he? What is he? How's he getting on in Ligue 1?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Bio joined the academy in 2004 when he was around, I want to say, 7 or 8 years old. So yeah, been there since he was a kid. And yeah, he was extremely prolific in Ligue 2 last season, topped the scoring charts, had a very kind of solid output in terms of goals and assists, and played a lot of minutes. So that ticks a lot of boxes. And it's always interesting for these players. You usually see quite a few players actually from Metz in the past and various other kind of teams which have very solid, prestigious academies. They have great form in Ligue 2, but can they actually translate it to Ligue 1? And we've definitely seen that with Bio so far. Scored at the weekend for his 5th goal of the season. And quite a few of them have been pretty varied finishes. He's definitely more of a kind of poacher type, and a couple who came against Bordeaux early in the season when he was kind of mopping up at set pieces. The one at the weekend was kind of positioned himself between the two centre-backs of Lorient. There was a nice ball over from the left-hand side, and he kind of cut through, carried a bit towards goal, and finished really clinically past the goalkeeper. So a bit of kind of everything to his game. And yeah, he definitely catches the eye just because of his age. His XG numbers are really, really good, especially from a promoted side who won't have a ton of quality, probably below average Ligue 1 side. Yeah, so he's been really interesting, and yeah, it's the sort of player you will see probably a lot of paper talk around him come January with a lot of Premier League clubs.
You wrote shades of Mauro Icardi, Luis Suarez, Paco Alcacer, which really hammers home the poacher's instinct part of his game. But perhaps someone who, you know, if we're trying to project to the very top level, might have a fair amount of development needed to develop a more well-rounded game to fit the sort of skill set of the elite nines in world football.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's something that he's had to do a little bit of kind of link-up play, and looking at some of the data, his retention there is not amazing, but you can probably get away with not having that at the lower level, you know, lower leagues. And he's been linked with West Ham, which is interesting because you can definitely see him as kind of a Antonio-like replacement who, I don't think his defensive workload's quite there, but some of the chances that they do create, you can imagine him being on the end of them. So, yeah, you know, for all these players, they're by no means the finished article. But Bio definitely has some traits which could be really, really handy for a few sides.
Perhaps playing at the highest level of the four that you picked out, both individually but certainly in terms of the club that he plays for, is Brahim Diaz, Milan's number 10. An interesting one, Tom, because he had big shoes to fill. Çalhanoğlu leaving for Inter Milan. And Brahim Diaz, not a like-for-like replacement for Çalhanoğlu, but a replacement that we like a lot and is doing very well so far.
He has shades of Jesse Lingard, and that's probably the only player that I could really think that has so many overlaps with him, both in terms of just he keeps his passes very short, he keeps the ball very well because of that. He kind of buzzes around from a defensive point of view and looks to kind of press and harry, and they're probably similar-ish size-wise. They're both, you know, pretty short guys, but very mobile. And also just the way they look to shoot. I mean, Lingard last season probably a bit more speculative than Diaz, but if you were to compare kind of Diaz's shot map with Çalhanoğlu's, Çalhanoğlu had a real penchant for very difficult long shots and really low quality efforts, and Diaz just doesn't have that at all. He's someone who really has been a bit more of a poacher and mopping up, you know, loose second balls in the box and block shots and things like that. So yeah, he's been an interesting one where Milan haven't gone for a kind of like-for-like replacement. They easily could have. I mean, they were linked to Dominic Szoboszlai not too long ago, who I think is probably quite close to Çalhanoğlu, technically at least, and look, you know, what he looks to do when on the ball and has that kind of similar shooting profile. But if you go for a like-for-like, you're kind of stuck with the same flaws of the player you had in the first place. And with Diaz, you have someone who is far more versatile as a winger. You know, he can play various positions probably all across that attacking midfield line, and Çalhanoğlu didn't really have the pace for that. So yeah, I think so far this is Diaz's third season, I think, at Milan, or second, and it's going on to be a 3-year deal with no option at the end. But yeah, he looks really good, and perhaps an outside chance to make the World Cup squad next year.
Michael, Milan back in the Champions League for the first time in, I want to say, 8 seasons. They've lost their first 2 games narrowly to Liverpool and Atletico Madrid, but they've won 6 and drawn 1 of their first 7 in Serie A. If someone wanted to find out a lot about AC Milan and their start to the season, where would be the best place for that?
There's a good article on them up on the site today by James Horncastle. They look like genuine title challengers. And they've done it so far without Ibrahimovic, who's only played 30 minutes, obviously, scored in that time. It was his 40th birthday on Sunday as well. So I did an article about him on the site. Some stats, but mainly a bit of a profile about his overall career. So, yeah, two articles to check out there.
Ibra's had to pull out of the Sweden squad through injury, and he's been replaced by one of the top scorers in the championship, England's second tier, Viktor Gyökeres of Coventry City. So there's your Ibra replacement, Sweden fans. And last but not least, Tom, in our data scouting across Europe, Odilon Kosunu, who, well, there's always emerging talent in the Bundesliga, that's for sure. And it feels like Leverkusen seem to have a new wonder kid centre-back every season. I was under the impression that Tapsoba was still the one to watch there, but you've got another one for us.
Yeah, they really do love a kind of big-name centre-back signing. And I think Tapsoba's been out for a few months now with an ankle ligament injury. And Kosunu's had to really come in, partner with Jonathan Tarr at the back and kind of hit the ground running. And they've done really well. I think they're second in the league at the time of recording. I like a lot about Kosunu. I think he's a very solid one-on-one tackler. I spoke to a couple of Premier League scouts for the piece because some of his numbers in terms of his aerial win rate and his quality in the air are really low for a centre-back, especially someone who's, 6'2". You'd expect them to be at least kind of average going for the fee that they went for. And that seems to be a flaw in his game, but the kind of both scouts echoed that they think it's fixable and he's a bit too eager and going for certain duels which he can't win, which I think is always an interesting example of where stats and scouts can really go hand in hand and overlap. But he's got a really nice long passing range. He's comfortable carrying the ball out at the back with his feet, and he just checks a lot of boxes in terms of what you'd want from a modern centre-back in 2021. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see him improve his performances, especially if Leverkusen can stay on their current trajectory and get even stronger at the back when Tapsoba comes back. He as well has been he's been really good so far this season.
Yeah, I wonder whose minutes Tapsoba will be after, whether it's the stalwart Jonathan Tarr or whether it is our friend Kosunu. One to watch anyway. Leverkusen, as you mentioned, have started really well this season. In fact, their next game in the league anyway is against FC Bayern Munich, first v second, and that one you can watch in the UK as well. So if you're interested in watching more of these guys, well, a good start after international break will be our friend Mohamed Ali Cho trying to outshine Kylian Mbappe and also Kosunu trying to keep Robert Lewandowski quiet. Thank you so much for that, Tom. I know that you made the point that we are only a few hundred minutes into the season, sample size wise, and ideally as a scout you're going to need a little bit more, but there's still value in flagging players up, and we're very grateful to you for doing that and for talking us through it. So thank you both for joining me on this pod. It's been an enjoyable episode for me anyway on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please do share on social media. We'd love to reach new listeners each week, and we've got a hell of an episode for you coming up next week. So make sure you are subscribed to this podcast feed. Check out The Athletic. You can sign up at theathletic.com/tactics. And we look forward to speaking again next week on The Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
The Athletic.